Hi, everybody. How are you guys doing? Good. Friday. The week is almost done. We're almost there. My name is Elsa. Thank you guys for joining us for this panel conversation today. We're going to be going into the ins and outs of Gen Z, the growing green climate sector, and what that means for people like us who are pursuing those climate endeavors. I'm going to have our wonderful panelists introduce themselves, and we can get to know them.
Well, good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for having us. My name is Daniel Ojo, pronouns he, him. I'm 24 years old, based in New York, and I am a multicultural brand strategist and equity practitioner. My background's in policy and politics, did the MPA, and now I do Gen Z marketing. I worked at a Gen Z marketing agency leading social impact work and helping brands better connect to Gen Zers who are more socially impact inclined and want to see brands show up for their values. So I help brands communicate about their sustainability efforts, racial equity efforts, gender equality, so on and so forth. And now I recently transitioned out of my advertising agency and now do this as a consultant. So super excited to be here with you all.
What's up, everyone? My name is Christy Drutman, and I am the co-CEO of Green Jobs Board, Inc. We are a company focused on getting people into climate jobs and making it easier for job seekers to build impactful careers addressing the climate crisis. So we're really about using storytelling, media, and connectivity to make it a lot easier for people to get started on a climate career, transition into it, and ultimately be able to make the impact in the world that we need to see. Thanks so much.
And obviously one of these things is not like the other. So I am not Gen Z. I am proudly 50 years old. However, the things that we do are focusing on ensuring their career, creating a climate forward future for people like in the Gen Z community and also Gen A as well. My name is Dr. Taj Eldridge, and I wear many hats in climate. I'm a managing director for climate innovations at Jobs for the Future, where we focus on providing grants to universities and nonprofits to help in the transition into the climate workspace. And in addition to that, I've been an investor for the last 15 years in the climate space, both from a fund standpoint and a startup standpoint as well. So we're really excited to have this conversation with everyone. So let's do it.
Perfect. I realized I forgot to introduce myself. My name is Elsa. I am the programming director at Black Girl Environmentalist. Black Girl Environmentalist is a national organization and network for Black women and gender expansive folk within the climate sectors. A little unknown fact for many, not for all of us, is that Black women, we tend to have some of the lowest retention rates within the climate sphere. And so that impacts us in a multitude of ways, and BGE is working on addressing that retention issue while also creating pathways and entry points for young girls and gender expansive folks who are wanting to do the work that we are doing today. I guess bringing us to our first question is the term climate quitting. Some estimates and some studies say that 40 to 50% of millennials and Gen Zs have left a job due to climate reasons. Could you guys define in your eyes what climate quitting is and if it's impacting the work that you're doing?
I would say that we're seeing this huge trend that more people are waking up to understanding the climate crisis and what's at stake and realizing that their day-to-day lives and the work that they do is kind of, the lines are getting blurred in that way where it's the work that you're doing in the world no longer is just confined to that we are seeing just catastrophic disasters everywhere. The call is here at the door, and it's people need to be able to answer that in the ways that they need to. And I think people are starting to realize that I like to be they're having their climate awakening moment of just being this is really scary. Or maybe they have their first kid. I hear a lot of people who have their first kid for the first time and then decide to quit their job or transition. I've been hearing a lot of that. I think whatever that pivot moment is for people, they're starting to recognize that these aren't issues that we can ignore, and that your standard 9-to-5, even though that is important from you're living your day-to-day life, there's this bigger existential crisis that is just looming that like has to be addressed. And I think more people are realizing that there's opportunities to transition and try to take accountability for that, which is exciting.
And I think something that's interesting that you said awakening is that I know, I'm sure a lot of you all have heard about the Great Resignation, right? 2020, 2021. I like to call it the Great Awakening because people were realizing that they needed to show up with their values at work, right? I think traditionally people would say, you know, you check your personal when you get to the door at work and you put it back on when you leave. And I think a myriad of issues, COVID, I think really showed that that's not possible anymore. And I think that this climate quitting is just another symptom of the Great Resignation and folks knowing and identifying that they have to show up with their values because those things are not divorced from themselves as an employee. And in fact, those impact their employee experiences in every capacity. So I think that this climate quitting thing is just another symptom of the overall awakening that especially young people are having when it comes to entering the job force.
Yeah, and I agree with both what Daniel and Christy said when we talk about the Great Awakening, because I think one of the things I always think about is an investor and a person who's creating the jobs that want to see the younger generation in this space, you have to think about the whole person, right? I think before, a lot of the times people only think where satisfaction and job satisfaction is with pay. And then we start seeing, well, job satisfaction was with the work-life balance, right? And now we're seeing job satisfaction with the work-life earth balance, where people are realizing that they have things that they care about. They want to see their jobs be more sustainable, not just their companies, but the companies is doing what they're donating to, but how can the work they're doing directly impact the things that they care about? And I think for me, that's the thing we have to see that's happening too in this great awakening that's occurring, not only with this generation, but also how employers and employees are going to have to act around that.
Definitely. I think one thing, I know everyone mentions it, but the pandemic, it changed the way that employers have to kind of address the job market in the sense that, okay, you clock in, you get your 9-to-5, you get your check, you leave, but what are the elements within the job that are fulfilling you? What resource groups, like what are you going outside of creating resource groups? How are you creating a space for employees to feel like they're contributing meaningfully? And how does that relate to not only the work-life balance, but the things that they are doing outside of the job? And so I think not really post-pandemic, but a couple years later, the job market and expectations in terms of what jobs and companies are offering people outside of a paycheck has definitely changed, and I think it's translating into climate quitting or simply people pursuing jobs that are aligned with their personal values. I guess another question would be, as we are discussing green jobs in the growing climate sector, the tech sector is a space that is continually growing. There's a lot of conversation about that. What are ways that Gen Z can leverage their experience and kind of get into the tech sector and pursue those career avenues?
Yeah, I'll take that. You know, one of the things we see, I'm a proud Texan. Even though I live in California, I was born and raised in Dallas, Texas, the son of immigrants. And one of the things I always think about is that in California, there's a lot of talk around climate tech companies and jobs opportunities there. Also in New York, also where Daniel is based. But I often think about the young folks who look like this panel. They're in places like Jackson, Mississippi, or St. Louis, Missouri, or some of these other areas where the tech ecosystem isn't as robust as, say, New York and San Francisco and the Carolinas and Miami. And so with that, what I often think about is that how can traditional industries in those states and in those cities be more sustainable in the type of jobs they're focusing on, use less carbon, and find out a way to ensure that jobs are available. As an example, you know, even the things I have for my body is from a sustainable standpoint, whether it's the diamonds that are made from carbon that have been captured in the air as opposed to dug up from the ground, the pants that are made from cactus as opposed to traditional animal leather. And so those things are opportunities where jobs can be had in there as well, because a lot of times when we talk about jobs in the workforce, we often think about EVs, we often think about energy or solar. But what I love about this industry that we all are in is that the type of jobs are diverse as the workers that are in the space. So I think that that's the thing we always have to think about when we're talking about jobs and opportunities for Gen Zers outside of tech hubs and ecosystems.
Yeah, I would speak for myself. Like, I do have a a dual degree in urban planning and environmental policy, but I use those degrees to then build a media and marketing career. And so, you know, I was able to channel my, you know, what I studied in school, like the technical knowledge and like the research and the policy knowledge. But then, you know, I built my own skill set to complement that to build, you know, a future career. And so a lot of people think, oh, media, marketing, communications, that can't be a green job. But like it definitely can and it is. And it's a massively growing industry. So I think, you know, I've met so many people that worked in traditional PR, media, comms, that then were like, oh, I'd rather do something instead of selling like a, I don't know, a bag to then maybe selling, you know, maybe climate policy and getting that passed, you know, instead. And I think it's really interesting to see how so many people are trying to figure out how to make these transferable skills happen. And I think the biggest thing is that we just need more storytelling and more mentorship and more ways to connect the dots for people. So, especially because this industry is so emergent and a lot of these jobs and these startups and these companies have only been around for maybe the past 5 or 10 years, like at most, in some ways. So I would say there's so much opportunity and you don't necessarily have to be a scientist to have a green job or to work in climate. And I think I'm like, a living, breathing example of that. Like, and so many of my other friends are too. You could have a finance background. You could have a media background. You can have a background even in sports. Like I'm participating in the Green Sports Alliance festival happening this summer. There's so many different alliances and initiatives that are thinking about this in an intersectional lens. And we just need to make people a lot more aware of that instead of staying in their own silos as like, oh, that's for the environmentalists, that's for the green people. It's like, no, you all are the green people too. So yeah.
I think the only thing I can add to that conversation is that I don't know a thing about tech. Like I use a phone and that's about it. But I do think it's really important, like Christy said, about storytelling. And I think we all have a story. And something I always say is that the personal is political. And when we get into these spaces, there is a story to tell, right? These technological innovations impact our daily lives. And what are those? And who are the communities that are being most marginalized? Who are the communities that are being most advanced? And what stories can you tell? In 2022, I helped Meta create their COP27 activation about elevating youth voices. And like I said, I don't know a thing about tech, but I do know that there are people in the Global South that have a story to tell about how the climate crisis is impacting them specifically. So what does it then look like to gather people from the Global South and have an intergenerational conversation about how the climate crisis is impacting their home countries and what can these tech companies and these different platforms do to help advance their own countries and really funnel resources back into them? So there always is a story to tell if you don't even have a traditional tech background. I know tech is a really big thing in sustainability spaces as well as fashion. So I do think there's always an in for people to get involved in any industry.
For sure. Thank you, Daniel. That actually brings us to our next conversation really and at a really good point. As we're talking about marginalized communities, a lot of the climate work that we're doing, it's not something we clock into. When we do, we leave it behind. It's something that we're very, very connected to. Our communities are very intertwined with these issues. So as young people are pursuing careers in the green space, what does it look like and how do we support and champion communities who want to do this work, but it's also very politically charged and personal for them?
Yeah, as I mentioned, growing up in the state, you know, a lot of times the conversation around climate can be a little bit obtuse, to say, for lack of a better word. But in some communities, there's this idea called code switching, that some of us use different languages and different ways of speaking at home or with our families than we do out in public. As an example, at home, I may speak more Spanglish because of that, the family atmosphere that's there. But in public, I probably use proper Spanish or proper English. But I think that we also need to have this idea of climate code switching, where we're talking about climate in a different way in different areas. So as I mentioned, we provided grants for a number of different organizations. And here in Texas, we provided a grant for an organization called Green Careers Texas to help make the transition for people in this state around green jobs. And those grants were part of this project that I lead called CREST, Climate Resilient for Employees for a Sustainable Tomorrow, in partnership with Ares Charitable Foundation. And you know, one of the things we said is that, you know, we want to make sure we're training people for green jobs and quality green jobs, where they're just not jobs where they can't have a good life balance like we talked about earlier. And so one of the things we just said is that, look, let's not even call them green. Let's not even call them sustainable. Let's just say we're creating jobs. And I think that that's one of the ways that we've allowed for the conversations to be more robust in regions where there's a disconnect between the impacts of climate and the laws and the policies that are in those states or in those regions. And so that's the things that we've tried to do, is really kind of take that idea of code switching and bringing it down to the climate space and talking about it. And I think Daniel and Christy mentioned this idea of storytelling. And I think that's extremely important, because you could tell the story of climate impact without even having to mention the word, right? So I think that's one of the things we often think about.
And building off of what you were saying earlier about investing in a whole person, right? That a person's not just their job, they have all these other extensions. It specifically speaks to the gaps that exist for communities of color to be involved in this work. To get people into these trainings to do things like electrification or getting trained for transportation, or any of these, you know, up and coming industries, that requires people to have the time, the energy, the resources, the transportation to even get to these trainings. They have to also have some sort of financial and emotional capital that goes into that, whether that be childcare services, being able to like maybe even have family support, and in having educational resources as well, because some people, you know, maybe want to work in this field but don't have a high school or even a college degree. How are we making sure that systemically we are creating a holistic model that every person is supported from a systemic standpoint to get into these jobs? Because currently in a lot of regions and areas of the world, people are still working for the oil and gas industry, or they're still working, you know, for Amazon or these other, you know, big corporations, because that's the only economic opportunities they have in their area. So if we want to compete with you know, those types of industries and be able to create, you know, jobs with equal, if not better, benefits, we have to think about those things. We have to think about, like, how are we making sure that someone from the jump is being supported, whether that be, you know, improving K through 12 education about what opportunities are out there. Then thinking about community colleges and how we're bridging that transitional gap to then when people actually go into these trainings, whether they're doing it through night school, after their 9-to-5 job, et cetera, how are we making sure that they are really supported from point A to point B? So I just wanted to say that I think when we're talking about communities of color, like, we have to talk about these other things because of historical histories of redlining, you know, systemic racism, things like that, that have prevented people from even entering STEM careers overall, but specifically in climate as well, even though they are the most impacted.
Absolutely. And here's a backup to what Christy was mentioning. And I definitely want to get the audience involved and ask you. So by show of hands, how many people, if you went to college, that your job in college is not related to what you studied in college? Show of hands. Anybody working in a field where their degree was not even relevant? I'll tell you a secret. My undergrad degree was in poetry. And I'm a VC, right? And even though I went to my MBA and did a PhD, but the reason I'm saying that is that, to Christy's point, is that I think also what's going to be happening as we talk about this idea of the intersectionality of race, socioeconomics, and learning is that sometimes degrees are going to be less important as opposed to skills. And you're going to see this idea of skill building, skill-based learning that's going to be important in our industry around climate, and also the delivery of those skills as well when we think about things like micro-learning, right? There's been this idea right now that we're seeing floating around about banning TikTok or even some people owning it that may not need to own it. But I look at that also, and I look at social media, and I look at the positive of it, because I look at it as an opportunity to learn and to have these micro learnings with it as well. If you're on TikTok, there's a fund called Fifth Wall VC, Fifth Wall Ventures, and they invest in the built environment or buildings, one of the most boring in place in VC that I think of. But the way that they present the information on TikTok really can educate you about the climate impacts of the buildings and houses we live in. So that's why I think it's really important to also think about the people who may not have college degrees, the people who may not even graduate from high school or community college, because now it's an opportunity for them to get into this space by focusing on skills-based learning as well.
And just a last piece on that, with Green Jobs Board, we built our platform out of social media using Instagram and social platforms because I didn't see great curation of resources being able to target communities or people like myself and others who didn't feel included in that conversation. We realized in that process there was so many accessibility gaps and that a lot of getting into jobs and climate, there's a lot of gatekeeping, and a lot of people in this industry, don't have access to paid internships or fellowships or programs that can clearly funnel them into this work or train them to make it transferable. So that's why it's so important that, there is more organizations and companies that are investing in some of those resources to educate people, to train them up, maybe even on site on the job, and making sure that they're thinking about it as a holistic model.
And I think the last part of your question is like getting people involved in this topic that feels so politically in charge. Like I just said, right, like the personal is political, but I also don't think that means that it's polarizing. And I think that language is really important. And I think that's something we often conflate is that if something sounds political, then it's polarizing. We can't have, like there can be no shared solution. My experience, working with like client facing and talking about marginalized communities, right, oftentimes I'm not talking to folks who are marginalized in the rooms who are making these decisions about what stories get told, right? My work is to amplify the stories that are pre-existing. And a lot of times clients will say like, that's not really our space, or we don't know what people think about that. And I always say, right, like, well, these stories, right, this issue is going to affect the bottom dollar, right? Like what is like the long-term operational viability of your business if you're not talking about sustainability, whether it's from like the consumer-facing end, whether it's from the employee base, like your business cannot fund without talking about these different social issues. And I think once you identify that with clients of like, this is actually impacting like your bottom dollar, this is actually going to like have a real substantial an influence, I think that's when folks kind of get more acclimated to the idea of perhaps entering the conversation, because it does feel politically charged. I think that language oftentimes is important in these situations, because that does not mean that we cannot all have a consensus when it comes to telling these stories or to figuring out solutions.
Yeah, those are all really good points. One thing I'd like to add is when it comes to the climate sector or the environmental sector, I think sometimes we tend to leave out high school students or students that don't come from a traditional four-year university, community colleges, like Christy mentioned. And so one thing that's really important to, I guess, kind of making sure that people understand that environmental work is larger than just the typical jobs that you see, is redefining the term environment. When you think of the environment, you think of just the nature, you think of outdoors, but more so our environments are the spaces we occupy. It's the space that we're in today. It's the access you have to food. It's the how many schools you have in your zip code versus how many prisons you have. And so all of that informs people's environments. And when you broaden that conceptualization for people, it makes it easier for people to say, hey, I can be an environmentalist. This is a career path I can take. It's not traditional, but it's something that is impacting the climate space. And so I think for a lot of high school students, there can be a disconnect as to how can I be an environmentalist? How can I pursue a career? What is tangible, et cetera? And so kind of broadening those ideas of what a climate career or an environmental career is really critical if we want to continue building those talent lines down the road. Our next question is, as the demand for green jobs continue to rise, what concerns do you guys have for young communities of color and marginalized people as they continue to navigate this career path? And as those issues arise, what are ways we can mitigate them?
Yeah, I would say like the biggest concern right now is, retaining people in this industry, making sure that there is like long-term ladders of career opportunity, and professional development. And that's a big thing that we've been thinking a lot about is like long-term mentorship and how can we be like making sure that people that have been in these careers for like 10, 20, 30 years are like, imparting knowledge and supporting young people right now. Because there's a huge intergenerational gap that's existing in this space. I think people from previous generation, or they're alive still, older generations, are like, they have access to all this like capital and resources and power, and like they're in these rooms that are like, the traditional guard, but it's like, How can they, you know, redistribute that? How can they make sure that they're advocating, whether they're on the boards of foundations or in these boardrooms, in these leadership positions, being like, we need to direct funding towards youth leadership. We need to be putting funds into paid internships, paid fellowships, and then thinking, what is this job or this career going to look like in 3 to 5 to 10 years? Because a lot of times, sometimes these jobs, it's like, okay, you can get through the door, but then you might be locked into that entry-level-ish salary in a lot of these jobs for way longer than if you were working at a traditional like tech job. And so I think these are the things that we're going to have to reckon with, because if you come from like a low-income community or a community of color and you have to support your family and you have to think about all these things, you're not going to want to take a job that's not going to lead to a more successful, prosperous career. And luckily the industry is shifting to have way better paying jobs, way better career opportunities, but I think not a lot of people know that that's even like an option. So we need to like continue to shift that conversation, and then employers and like these actual organizations and companies from the inside need to address making sure there's infrastructure and support systems so that way talent doesn't leak through the cracks.
In addition to that, and not to get all Karl Marx in the room, but something that always concerns me with any kind of like social equity movement is this process of like co-optation and like bottom of the pyramid projects, which essentially is like what is the biggest threat to an issue, right? And how do we neutralize this, right? Sustainability is a trend in some people's eyes, right? People are talking about this a lot more, and these things like, and when we really interrogate, you know, what is the root cause of these things, right? A lot of times it's capitalism, right? And not having profit purpose alignment, and in order to maintain dominance, right? Capitalism, the powers that be, et cetera, will have to co-opt the narrative and neutralize it in a way so that it doesn't actually yield the efforts that you want and the folks that on the stage are working towards. So it oftentimes looks like, you know, you go from having a lot of racial equity conversations in 2020 following the murder of George Floyd, and then you end up with people saying, oh, well, we shouldn't have Eminem characters because they're not diverse or whatever, right? It's like that core essence of what was being talked about and what was being said has now been diluted into something that might be seen as inconsequential, but it's all as a means to actually not yield the social change that you want. And working like, you know, on brand side and helping these brands come up with like campaigns that talk about these issues, I'm always worried about co-optation and these bottom of the pyramid projects, because it seems like if I'm telling these stories in a way that's not super intentional, it could just be seen as a trend. I think most recently, a lot of us maybe have seen, if anyone here is a fan of SZA, SZA had a Grammys performance in partnership with MasterCard. And at the end, it was actually about like the climate and climate change. This is no critique on MasterCard or SZA by any means, but one could then inquire and say, okay, well then, what is this about? Is this like, do we just have to plant trees? Is it just a save the trees moment? And without like having that critical lens or even just having more knowledge about the climate space in general, I think sometimes we get into these dilemmas of not knowing exactly what we're actually fighting towards anymore. And I think a lot of times when big actors in the space who want to do well, but maybe not necessarily partner with the correct folks or know exactly how to communicate these things, the core essence of what we're fighting for is then neutralized, that we never actually get to yield the profits that we want. And oftentimes that's just a product of late stage capitalism.
Yeah, good points, Danya and Christy. And I think Elsa, when I think about the challenges for this new workforce, it comes in the form of one word, and that's change. And here's a question for the audience by show of hands. How many people own an EV here or have ridden an EV, like for Uber or Lyft, by show of hands? The reason I'm asking that is because I think that we have to think about the jobs that we're having here and the challenges that we're having is that we're still in the adolescent phase of climate and our focus on this idea of mitigation. The reason I said is I look at the Obama administration and that interaction with Jobs and Green as the infancy phase, and a lot of things happened there, and now we're in the adolescent phase. The reason I ask about EVs is because this is a perfect example of change. Right now, when we have lithium batteries and others that are powering our vehicles, there's a bit of extraction that comes into that, right? Has anybody ever heard of artisanal mines in the Congo, where cobalt is mined for EVs? And so not only is this happening there, but it's some of the places here in our own country and indigenous lands where those things are happening. So I give it an example because there are startup companies. One is called Lyten, L-Y-T-E-N, that's figuring out a way to produce batteries for EVs that don't need that doesn't use cobalt and some of these other rare earths. And so I say all that to say that the technology that we're talking about within climate to help us get to this 1.5 degrees and also further ensure that we have this adaptation after is going to be changing. And I think that workforce is going to have to be able to mold with that change. I think further, and as is evident here by even this panel, I think those of us who are not Gen Zs or are still in the workforce, whether millennials or Gen Xs working alongside the Gen Z community, are going to have to also understand that the way we work is going to be different from the way our predecessors will work as well. And the way they come to the space, it's already changed in the idea that we've all talked about this idea of work-life balance and work-earth balance. But I think that's the operative word when we talk about the challenge that we need to face is being open and adaptive to change.
Yeah. I'd like to add, I think one thing I've noticed that young people we face in this space is funding. Climate careers, they're nothing new, but they're growing, they're expanding. There's been a rise of a lot of Gen Z-led climate groups and young-focused solutions, et cetera. But we have to fund those jobs. Like, you have to pay people, right? But oftentimes foundations, they're giving one-time grants or they're not taking into consideration what does long-term investment into youth-led solutions look like. And so how are we attracting and retaining talent if we're not compensating them, in comparison to what our counterparts are, our competitors are, et cetera. And so it also looks very different for founders of color and things of that nature. And so it's the conversation to have around centering young people as we are pursuing these careers, but funding them and making sure that they're having the same, if not comparable, resources as other groups who are doing similar work. And so one thing we did want to touch on was, as young people are looking for jobs in this space, how do you maintain your integrity as you are competing for jobs of different scale, of in different spheres of work, et cetera?
Yeah, I would say for, you know, Green Jobs Board, the journey has been interesting because a lot of it's been organic. A lot of it's been organizations and companies that have been really interested in just what we stand for, which is like having this central place for people to find opportunities in the green space. And so with that being said, that's like a wide net, right? We're just saying green jobs. And like some people always ask, like, what do you define as a green job? And for me, you know, I define that as any job that is focused on, you know, improving the livability, the sustainability, the breathability of the planet. And ideally, you know, if we're gonna say, then add a qualifier to that, a quality green job is a job that pays well, has benefits, has transparency, has mentorship opportunities, leadership, professional development opportunities, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the difference between filtering between a green job and a quality green job gets really nuanced because it depends on what you're looking for, your educational background, what you need, where you're coming from, what your values are. And so there's a lot of layers to it. But I'd say for us, like, there's been a few times that fossil fuel companies have tried to post with us, and I know there's some other job boards out there that are like, oh, well, like, those could be green jobs too. But you gotta draw the line in the sand somewhere, and I guess for us, like, we don't post any jobs specifically from the fossil fuel industry, and again, maybe some other job boards, if they are transitioning and people want to do that, they're okay with that. That's just not like where we're at. But that doesn't mean like those people don't deserve jobs. Like, people that work in these industries, again, I understand it's the whole person. So it's like, if you want to transition, again, then that's like a gap in work that like people like myself and other people need to do, where it's like, well, if you want people to leave their oil and gas job, what industry are you transitioning them into where they can have those transferable skills? So that's like the legwork that the industry needs to do to, like, again, make it more palatable, make it exciting for people, make sure it pays well, competitive salary, competitive benefits. And so that's just like an industry-wide issue, and making sure that there's funding for that and making sure that people know that these opportunities are out there. But yeah, I would say that like the difference between green jobs and quality green jobs, I think we have to keep raising the standard and we have to keep defining what that is and what that means, so that way the whole industry levels up and then job seekers feel like they have a place in it.
I would say, in terms of keeping integrity, just be honest with someone, whether it's yourself, other people, ideally both. like I said, my background's in like policy and politics. I thought I was gonna be like the next Barack Obama. I saw him be inaugurated when I was 8. I was like, okay, perfect, me next. So I went to like grad school for like public policy, and I was in there, and I was like, I don't know if this is right for me. I wish I knew that before I got the loan, but I thought that because I just knew that I didn't want to be a figure that people would look up to and me know that I was not going to be the change that they wanted, right? Whether because I'd be another cog in the system or whatever the case may be, I didn't want to lead anyone astray in the same ways that I felt like I had been led astray by other political figures growing up. And now I make multicultural brand marketing, you know, campaigns when it comes to like social impact efforts and these other things. And I made that transition because I was like, I don't want anyone to look at me and think that I am going to be the leader of the next revolution. I wanted to. I realized I wasn't going to be able to within the capacity that I was going towards. And I think that's okay. I think sometimes, like, for whatever reasons that they may be, whether it's because I'm first-generation American, my family relies on me in some capacity, et cetera, just be honest about what you're doing and why you're doing it. I think so many times people get into the space and, listen, I love making money. I think everyone loves making money, right? We have to survive. But then at the end of the day, that's okay. That's a choice that you made. But then just be honest with yourself about what you're doing, why you're doing it, and then don't lead anyone else astray. And then when it's time for you to move to the side, if that's the choice that you take, I think the next step for you is just to then, when someone else comes up behind you and is ready to lead, you move out the way for them, right? I've come to terms with not being the next Barack Obama or MLK or whoever, and that's fine, but I do think that because that's a value that I have, that when the next person comes up behind me and pushes me out the way and says, hey, listen, you work for a big company and I need you to move out the way to further the next generation, I should be happily moving out of the way. And I think that is something just to know when your time is up and know that the movement is not going to start and end with you, and then just being honest about what you're doing and why you're doing it. I think people will be okay with that.
Yeah, I think, you know, when we talk about integrity for this work and authenticity, one of the things I always think about is how the impacts our mental and how the impacts our idea. With climate anxiety is one of the things we see a lot with all type of generations, but particularly this generation that we're talking about today in their actions. You know, there was an article that came out recently where an executive from Exxon kind of placed the blame on climate on us as consumers and individual. And a lot of us know that that's not necessarily the case. There's this old adage in Africa that says many hands make light work. And what that means for me is that this idea of having a climate forward future or a climate friendly future, or getting to understand and we get to the 1.5 degrees Celsius, is a community effort. So it's not only the jobs that we do, it's not only the things we purchase, but also corporations have to make different decisions. Our government has to make different decisions. So when I think about that idea of integrity, an idea of authenticity, what I'm thinking about as well is for us not to internalize a lot of those things, but realize it's more than just us that has to make decisions, so that way it's not so much weight on our shoulders for this idea that we have to do. And then that integral part of that is ensuring that, you know, the choices that we make from a consumer standpoint, or the choices that we make from, you know, being present standpoint of attending certain events and things of that nature, can fit into the idea of creating this climate-friendly future.
I love it. So far, we've talked about a plethora of topics. The last one we want to hone on is, I guess, everything we've talked about so far. Is it a fad? Is sustainability a fad? Is climate quitting a fad? Are the green jobs we're pursuing, is it just a trend? Or is it long term? And how are we here for the long haul?
You know, I think that the way that things are going, I think there's going to be a huge shift. And I think just with how the market is shifting in general, there are a lot more companies and organizations that are like reckoning with their, you know, need to address like their environmental social governance standards or whatever. And again, whether or not they like fulfill those things is like a whole other thing. But I think we are going to continue to see more companies and people in general talking about this topic tenfold, maybe even like putting a lot of money behind it tenfold. But a lot of these people have never really been in the space or like maybe understand what the solutions are, or the communities being impacted. They don't have the same language as those of us on the stage. And you know, for better or for worse, that means those funds and those opportunities are going to be out there. But to like direct that in a strategic way and make sure that that's being done in the best ways possible, it requires leadership from people that, you know, have, you know, been in these spaces for a while to create that accountability and again create those standards. So I think we're going to see like a both and. I don't think it will just be a fad, but I think people are going to latch onto it, maybe use the same types of language and care and be passionate about it, but they might not be the most effective or strategic. So that's where consultants and other people are going to be really important. Strategic leadership, making sure again that we're like young people and young leaders are being given the opportunity to be in those rooms to lead those spaces as well. So
yeah, and I look forward from the audience getting questions from the audience from us as well, because I think this has been a really great conversation for me especially. You know, when I think about the word and people talk about fad, I think about August 11, 1973, when hip hop in New York was kind of coming to fruition, and a lot of people in the 80s said, "Oh, it's just a fad." And here we are 50 years later, and it's still here. And it weaves more than just music. It's in the products we buy. It's in the style that we do. It's in the vernacular. It's in culture. I think the same thing is going to happen with climate, that in you know, knock on wood, 50 years from now, when I'm long gone, and these folks are still here, we're going to have this same conversation that climate is not just a fad. Because even once we reach those levels, like I mentioned, by 2030, we have to continue to be sustainable, to continue to take care of our earth and our resources, because that's what climate is. It is about resources and taking care of those things. And so I think that that's the same thing we'll be having, is this idea where the idea around climate and jobs is going to morph and it's going to change. As Christy said, that climate jobs are going to be more than just transportation, more than just energy and grid management. It's going to be ingrained into everything that we do. And I think that that's the beauty of the work that we're doing, is that we're opening up this vision, this aperture about what a green job is, how to attain it, and what are the pathways to it. So I'm looking forward to years from now when this conversation that we're having becomes so much commonplace that you don't need to have a breakout session at South by Southwest or Aspen or many others, because it just becomes part of our lives and part of the work and part of the culture.
So is sustainability a trend? I hate to be a pessimist. Actually, I don't hate it at all. By the end of 2021, a lot of the work that I do is like Gen Z, like trend forecasting. What are people going to be talking about? And I like to say, like, I'm an internet anthropologist, right? And look at like a myriad of different issues, whether it's like the economy, geopolitics, et cetera, because those are the things that create trends, whether it's in beauty, fashion, skincare, et cetera, right? These different factors create the trends that we see. So by the end of 2021, I was like, I think that the next conversation will be sustainability, because if we're being honest here, it's a conversation that more people are able to be a part of and profit off of, right? We know what 2020 was like. We know what 2021 was like. We know that these things, a lot of people made a lot of money during those times by becoming activists, by, you know, DEI consulting, right? The multicultural marketers of the world, right? There was opportunity, right? And opportunity is not a lengthy visitor. So people were able to latch on. But so I knew that with sustainability, it was a space that felt like there was room for more types of people to engage. There was room for more types of industries to engage in ways that also did not include any kind of like recrimination of the past, right? And have to come to terms with their racist histories, et cetera, like a lot of the moons that we saw in 2021. So I knew that this was going to be a conversation that was really going to be big in 2024. And as you can see, if you ask a lot of your activist friends in the equity space, racial equity space, they'd say, "Oh, I haven't gotten enough brand deals recently, or I haven't been getting a lot of brand deals or opportunities anymore because those things cycle." Now, does that mean I don't think it's going to be impactful, and that like things like I said, these trends come to place because there is tension, right? There's a perfect storm because of these other issues that are going on that create sustainability to be the topic that people are talking about. And I think it's kind of up to us, but also us in the room, to use this opportunity to make sure that it is long-lasting. Just because the trend cycles have cycled and hit sustainability does not mean that it has to move on as quickly as they always do. And I think it's now that we know that this is trend, right? An opportunity is not a lengthy visitor, to take as much advantage as we can right now when all eyes are on us to act responsibly, to make sure that we actually are creating sustainable and long-term solutions for the problems that we're seeing.
Perfect. Now we're gonna move into Q&A. I see a hand up. Did you have a question?
Yeah, I do. I wonder if everybody...
You wanna go to the mic? think it's in the middle, right? Is it working? Let's hear that beautiful voice, please.
I wonder if each one of you on the panel would give us an example of your vision of an entry-level job for perhaps a high school graduate that could go into a green job, and ideally in your vision of how this would work, what kind of things could lead him through, him or her through a more prosperous career and making more complicated subject steps as he goes on through the career?
Yeah, I love that question. And I think that for me, there's a myriad of opportunities, but I'll start with one on apparel. And the reason I like apparel and talk about that is that a lot of people don't realize that apparel causes more greenhouse gas emissions than aviation and shipping combined. So if we really want to talk about reducing emissions, let's go there. And I think that there's an opportunity for jobs, especially for people right out of high school, to go into apparel manufacturing. Like I mentioned with these pants I have that are made from cactus or anything else. And I think that's an area that we can see. And I think the quality aspect of it that Christy mentioned, that we both mentioned, is that ensuring that job and that company that's directing that space on the manufacturing side creates a new idea around manufacturing, where the people, the whole person can be there, where it's a great pay, where it's an opportunity to where they have this work-life balance. I think the ascension of that as well is that where it starts on the manufacturing floor, that person can rise within the company, because at the end of the day, the manufacturing company sells products. And I think that's where we kind of go into the space, to where the ascension is from creating the product to selling the product to partnering with other partners in that space. And so I think for me, that's a perfect example of a job pathway. That's not necessarily, you know, we have a lot of examples with electricians that go into the area. We have a lot of examples of others on the auto tech side. But I think that that's a really kind of different way where you can have a person go into that space and have the skills and a skill set to work within the company as well.
I would say that there's huge opportunities when it comes to environmental education and media and marketing, especially like starting for high schoolers, because a lot of institutions now are trying to figure out K-12 education. So I think there's opportunities for a high school student to even support with building out some of that curriculum and, like, you know, talking with their teachers or talking with other people. And again, those initiatives are across the board, but if like it doesn't exist at your school currently or in your school district, like I could see like a high school student maybe supporting and kind of being like a, you know, interim consultant in that way, right? Consulting on, you know, how could we improve climate education in my high school? And that's already like you building a curriculum. You already are building a portfolio for yourself of writings and information. I could see from there, they could take that information of how they built that curriculum and start practicing thought leadership, writing blogs, producing media, producing videos, content. And that already is like super helpful and profitable in a lot of ways to a lot of these climate tech companies that are looking, especially for young people who understand how to do trend forecasting or how to use these platforms way faster than they can if they hired these really fancy PR marketing agencies, to like have this someone that's like new on the scene to support them. And so I could see it going into like that direction where then maybe that company then exposes that person to the industry, exposes them to solar, wind, whatever, while they're learning comms and marketing. They're going to these conferences, they're learning about the industry, then maybe they could take on some technical training and learn from there, and then from there they could, like, you know, spiral upwards towards doing even technical writing and helping with things like that. There's like so many opportunities that you could do from just like taking one thing of like something you can do in your classroom to then building a whole career out of it. And I think this generation is really good about thinking about maybe the concept of a portfolio and maybe not even going to college, necessarily speaking, if you don't want to go that route, or even if you do, to have this like curation of case studies and information to showcase the work you've done and to build that expertise and not just wait until you have a PhD or whatever to already be out in the field. So I think that's like a really exciting, amazing opportunity that exists right now if, you know, there's a high schooler out there that was ready to just like go all in. So yeah.
I just want to add, I think one important avenue or one way many of us don't think of is community organizing. The first time I got involved with environmentalism was in high school, and I got involved with a group of students across the country who wanted to put together one of the first ever global youth climate marches. And so we had a group of 15 to 20-year-olds, maybe 14-year-olds, we even had a 13-year-old on the team, who were very passionate about climate and making sure that the national conversation surrounding it changed. And so all of us pursued our personal interests in the lens of climate. We had people who are good with numbers, so they were doing finance. They were doing the numbers. They were doing the fundraising. They were putting together the inquiries to foundations to figure that out at 15. We had people who were good with people, and so they were the ones on the ground talking to people, getting them invested. They were using their storytelling abilities and their ability to connect with people to draw people in, whether that was digitally through comms and media, whether that was through the relationships they cultivated with PR agencies and doing the press releases and things of that nature, or it was using their physical voice in person or on the internet to catapult the movement that we were creating. There were people who had really great ideas and thoughts. They were doing the programming. They were doing the long-term visioning. There were people that were good with logistics and operations. They were the ones that were planning out, okay, this is the route of the march, this is who we should get involved, et cetera, et cetera. And so at the time in high school students don't have a lot of opportunities that are readily available for them. Internships are typically reserved for college students. And so I think one way of getting high schoolers to really have a viable path to entry-level positions is to create those opportunities themselves and to have adults who are not only present, but sponsoring them and connecting them and utilizing their networks to invest in the youth so that the youth can continue doing that work. And then hopefully over time, as you are pursuing their community organizing, they're finding the pathways that are unique to their talent. And over time, they have a career that they have had lots of experience in simply just by having an interest in the work that they have in the first place.
Amazing. Hi, all. My name is Mariam, and this has been the most deeply resonant of all the panels I've attended this week. And I normally wouldn't plug my own work, but I have a nonprofit called Second Day that creates paid internships and social impact. So totally resonate with that. And I'm currently working on a values-first, skill-based hiring platform because of exactly what you mentioned, Dr. Elridge. So happy to talk about that with anyone who's interested. So I attended a lot of panels this week on Gen Z because everybody's buzzing about Gen Z. And I work with a lot of Gen Z in the work I've done. And something that stood out to me is that a lot of folks in the room, when they hear about what Gen Z cares about, what they're pushing for in the workforce, there's a lot of skepticism, a lot of head shaking and eye rolling and all of this sort of attitude, which is really frustrating to watch. And I'm curious, in the climate space, kind of given the nature of the work that y'all do every day, are you finding people are more open to what Gen Z has to say, or is that similar kind of skepticism and eye rolling happening, or does it really depend on the environment you're in? I see your mic is ready, you have thoughts.
Yes, so I spent the last 2 years of my life working at a Gen Z marketing agency, which I'm sure we'll go like, what the heck is that? Exactly. And a lot of the clients that we would have would be like, well, how do you know? Well, what do you know? You know, and there's often that pushback, right? I've only lived for 24 years, what can I really know? I do think that being young is always going to be something that people just immediately like dox you points for. I'm like, well, I don't think they know what they're talking about. I think in any space that young people enter and try to lead conversations, that is the reaction. However, research does show that Gen Zers are shopping with value in mind. A research study that I put out a few years ago showed that 44% of respondents said that they believe that corporations and for-profit organizations are responsible for mitigating the climate crisis. So I think when folks see those numbers, they understand that their consumer, right, Gen Z has huge buying power. They see that their consumer actually is going to shop with that in mind. And I think that kind of makes them open their ears a little bit more. But I do think that in general, when young people lead conversations and really interrogate these big organizations, these big corporations, that they're going to be met with pushback because we are often gaslit in those meetings into thinking that we don't know what we're talking about. But I'd love to hear from
you. As the non-Gen Zer, I think for me, my role has always been to ensure that young people have a voice. I think the whole idea of America that I love is that this idea of possibility is the possibility we have two 75-year-olds running for president. So we have also the possibility of people under the age of 30 that can make a lot of decisions that really impact the area that we're doing. Ironically, this is the third in a series of talks that I've had and I've hosted with young folks. I know Christy joined us last year in New Orleans with a number of different Gen Zers, and then Elsa joined us in DC. And so for me, the idea is how can I step out of the way so that way the audience can hear these voices and direct from them about ways that they see their future, they see their present, and ultimately that would be the past for all of us.
Yeah, I would say as a Gen Z founder, who's like, you know, at the beginning of like, you know, building my own company, I have faced a multitude of microaggressions. Just like people think, oh, like, who do you work for? Like, I've been asked that so many times. Like, when I'm like, oh, like, I'm with, you know, Green Jobs Board, and I'm introducing myself to some of, like, these VCs or these climate tech companies, and people will be like, oh, who's your boss? And I'm like, I'm the boss. Thanks. And, you know, I've had to learn. I've had to, again, tap into my mentors, tap into a lot of the networks that I have to, again, create legitimacy for the work that I do. And that's kind of the name of the game. So there is this interesting thing where, like people that are Gen Z, like, if people don't view us as those experts, like, we need allies. We need people who are creating that legitimacy for us, whether that be through certification, whether that be through getting us into these rooms to speak or being in leadership positions or, you know, I think it requires a little bit of discomfort and intergenerational support and allyship to make that possible. And I think the more that we see that, I think there's so much to be learned from all sides, and I think that people in general need to shift their own conception of that, because, yeah, otherwise, like, you're going to be pushed out. So it's going to happen regardless. So, yeah.
And for the others in the room, I just also want to, like, take time, if you're not a Gen Z or if you engage in a lot in, like, intergenerational dialogue, I'm sure it's one of the most frustrating things you can experience is not being believed. Like, imagine telling someone your truth over and over again, and then they're just dismissing it, and they're not believing you, right? That's pretty hurtful. And I think a lot of things as well is, like, the things that Gen Z is talking about, they're not new topics. I think I also hear that a lot, right? Like, well, you want work-life balance. Millennials said that first, right? Nothing that we're saying in terms of the values that we want are too disjoint from what we've talked about. Our approach is just different because we have different lived experiences. I always say our lives are like bookmarked by like 9/11 and COVID-19, but we've experienced like a plethora of like life-altering, like unprecedented times in our life. So our approach to things are a lot different. But what we want ultimately is to be in community with each other, right? We want connection. We want to feel like we belong somewhere and like we belong to others. And I think that a lot of times, because of our age, folks think that we don't have enough credit or we don't have enough experience to want the same things. But ultimately, the core of the conversation is the same that a lot of other generations have talked about in the past. Why this conversation didn't start with us, it won't end with us. But it's always important to lead with empathy and understanding, and just understand that we do have a lot of common ground that we're entering these conversations with.
This was a beautiful conversation. We are at time. If each of you guys could maybe share just one final thing you'd like to add or where people could find you, that would be perfect.
Yeah, people can find me, Christy Drutman, on LinkedIn. You can check out our website, greenjobsboard.us, and we're on all social media, Green Jobs Board. Thanks.
I want to leave you all with, if you have a child, a grandchild, a younger sibling, you should talk to them, try to learn more about them and what shapes their experiences. I think a lot of times the work that I do with clients sometimes is also helpful, like with their kids, right? Because you're able to engage with someone who's younger and you can relate to them a little bit more. I'm not your kid, but maybe you can relate to your kid because of it. And my name is Daniel Ojo, spelled Ojo, like O-J-O. You can find me on LinkedIn and ojonyc.com for my website. And if you want to connect afterwards, let me know. We can chat.
You can always find me under a hat. So also on LinkedIn, Taj Ahmad Eldridge. And thank you all so much for being engaging and listening to a lot of these conversations here around Gen Z and green jobs.
Thanks.
Thanks, everyone.